Last time, we looked at chapter 3, where we saw how the list of names was given to us about those who were working on the wall from different locations in Jerusalem, and how they were contributing, some who were from Jerusalem, how some who are from surrounding towns and areas who came to work. And then there was some sense of unity among people when it came to this work, that they all joined in this goal of rebuilding the walls and gates. And we saw the 10 gates mentioned, 10 out of 12 gates mentioned, they were being repaired. And there was an exception. Nobles from Tekoa were the ones who really didn't contribute to anything, but there's those who did work on their part, and they moved to another part to contribute. There was also women who worked at the wall. So it was kind of a great chapter to see how God uses all sorts of people for his work. Now, as we enter in chapter 4, we now encounter the continued problems that they will face in this rebuilding effort. So let's go and read verse 1. But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." So, upon kind of hearing the success that Nehemiah had in getting people to work and working now on the wall, they got really, really upset. Now, if you remember from chapter 2, Tobiah and Sanballat were obviously aware of this effort of Nehemiah to come and rebuild the walls, because, as we mentioned previously, Sanballat most likely had some kind of a role, a governor-style role in that region. And he was familiar that Nehemiah had a king's blessing upon this endeavor. And so in chapter 2 and verse 10, we saw how when he heard that this is happening, he was disturbed that somebody was seeking a well-being of the Jews. And then in following verse 19 of the same chapter 2, he started kind of spreading lies by saying, "Will you rebel against the king?" He asked that question. And he was ultimately trying to destroy Nehemiah's integrity and intent. He was spreading lies about what Nehemiah was actually trying to do. He was not rebelling against the king, obviously. But that was the beginning of the resistance from the enemies. And as we mentioned, it started with lies. And now it comes to the point of mockery. Now, as they're actually doing the work, now they're going to mock their work, what they're doing for the Lord. And this initial attack was with lies. And sometimes, as we discussed, lies can be enough to discourage sometimes believers in doing the work of the Lord. It's just false information given out about them, and things that are untrue being spread is enough at times to discourage people of God to do the work of God. In this case, Nehemiah wasn't discouraged, and therefore he decided now to really focus on doing the work, and they're doing the work, and now the ridicule comes along. And it's the tactic of the enemy to distract them, to take their eyes off the work and start paying attention to the words of the enemy. They had their job was to rebuild the wall, but they wanted them to not listen to ultimately, what they're supposed to do, but to listen to these words of ridicule. And it's interesting that, when you think about how it said, what it's saying to them is, "Can you do anything good?" You can do anything good. Anything you try to do is going to be so feeble and useless that even if a fox was to come, it will just knock the walls down. You don't know what you're doing. And, you know, and to an extent, maybe that was true. Maybe they were not truly knowledgeable to the fullest extent to what they were doing. Probably not the case, but even if it was. When you think about this in our lives as well, is if we desire to serve the Lord, to do things for the Lord, oftentimes God will call us to do things that we're not necessarily knowledgeable in doing. But if we step out in faith, He meets us at that place of stepping out. He will give us the strength and what we need as we step in faith to do what we're called to do. And so if the enemy comes and says, well, you don't know what you're doing, you can just say, yes, absolutely, you're right. I don't know what I'm doing. But at least I'm trusting the one who has called me to do it. And that's what they're doing. And again, the whole point of what we're going to see in this chapter is going to be challenges from the enemies, is to distract them. They have a goal, and their goal is finish the wall, and everything that the enemy will try to do is to discourage from that goal happening. And it's a great parallel when we compare our life, our walk with the Lord, and how the enemy tries to work in our lives. Our ultimate goal in life is to grow in our faith, to glorify God as we grow in our faith, to bring praises to Him as we serve Him daily. But as we live this life, we are to grow. We are to build our life. And that's what the enemy does not want us to do. He doesn't want us to build our spiritual life, our spiritual man, our spiritual woman. He doesn't want that to grow. He wants us to remain in the place that we originally were when God found us. In rubble, in rubbish, as they point out. There's this rubble, this rubbish, and that probably is the remnant from the time of destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC when Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed the city. And so this challenge is being brought up before Nehemiah. And challenges are obviously things that we don't always desire, but they're good for us, just like they will be good for Nehemiah and people, even though at the moment when this is happening, I'm sure they're not thrilled about it. Because challenges have their way of bringing us closer to God. Now, in one way, when we are faced with a thing that, let's say, we are not that familiar, we're doing something that we haven't done before, that challenge can really bring us close to God. But on the other hand, when we are to do something that we're maybe good at, that we know what to do, then we have an opposite challenge. And that is the challenge of not trusting ourselves and our ability, but trusting God in it. And that's a different kind of a challenge that's also very important to deal with. In whatever challenge we face, we always have to face it with God being our first source of help. And it's never good to kind of rely, well, I've done this many times, so I'm just going to rely on that. And I find it fascinating how, as we discussed in our, when we did a topical study of Nehemiah and the prayers, is that God is going to use these men, Sanballat, Tobiah, in Nehemiah's life, in this community. In many ways, it would be easy for God to deal with them, but God will use them to deal with His own people, to teach them, to trust Him. And so, this man, Sanballat, I find fascinating. When you look what it's how he's described here, he was furious and very indignant. Why? Why was he so furious? Well, I think one of the obvious answers would be the fact that he hated Jewish people. And as I mentioned in chapter 2, verse 10, he was upset that somebody was seeking a well-being of the Jews. In many ways, Sanballat was infused with the spirit of Haman, who desired ill for the Jews and destruction of the Jews. And maybe Sanballat hoped for the destruction, maybe him to be an instrument of destruction of the Jews. I don't know. But it is clear from just his reaction that he has a hatred for God's people. And again, as we mentioned in our study on Sundays, it's always been the case and always will be the case. You want to follow the Lord, there will be people who will hate you. It's just, you can't avoid that. It will be wonderful if people will love us because we are to love, but that's just not the case. And the word that he uses here is this word feeble. What is feeble Jews doing? And this Hebrew word, it describes a dying plant, something that has just maybe a few days, few weeks left of life. It's the very last breath type of a thing. So it's interesting, he's using this language that he expresses this hope of seeing this nation being destroyed. They're dying off. And you know, throughout history, enemy always wanted that, to destroy the people of God. And it's an interesting, it was true with a Jewish nation, and it's also true of a Jewish nation today. And throughout, you know, the history, last 2,000 years, there was times when they really faced difficult times. But it's also true for the church. There was times in church history where the enemies wanted to destroy the church and looked upon the church as a feeble group. You're dying, you're going away. And even today, a lot of people want to refer to Christianity, that we are dying away, which is obviously not the case. And oftentimes I find, and it's scripturally we can see, that when the enemy is the loudest and strongest in his opposition is actually because people or God are growing stronger and stronger and making a greater impact. And so he's expressing this here. And I just want to touch a little bit about hatred because I think it is important. And obviously this man is filled with hatred. And it's, you know, no surprise. But hatred is a dangerous thing. You know, hatred doesn't produce anything good, ever. Hatred will never draw you to actions of love or compassion or productive things. It always brings destructive results. Yet, you know, in our world today, we get to see all these social causes that are being brought up over and over again of people who want to oppose supposed people who are hateful. And the way they oppose those hateful people, they oppose them with hatred. And so it doesn't produce any good. In our society, before our eyes, we're witnessing, in a sense, growing animosity and anger that people have because they're allowing hatred to lead them. And, you know, it's not just that one group of people are faced with hatred. Every group of people are faced. It's not just we are faced with hatred by those, but also there's those who maybe oppose us who are faced with hatred by some Christians. And hatred will never produce any good. And temptation is when you're being hated and ill spoken of is to respond hatefully in anger. And that will never produce results intended. It's actually, hatred is a bait of the enemy. He uses people to hate because they're being blinded and inspired by him to get others to hate. Because the most natural reaction would, if you were to face somebody in front of you, let's just all of a sudden shows up in front of you, starts swearing at you, doing all these, saying all sorts of things, your natural reaction would be what? To respond back. The same language. And that's what the enemy was hoping here. To distract Nehemiah. Respond. Respond to this attack. Respond to this hatred. And it, if we, you know, catch the bait of the enemy, well, we're going to be acting according to his will and not God's will. And one of the things that it's clear from one of the things he's saying here, will they offer sacrifices, he asks. He wants to attack their worship. And that's what enemy truly wants when he attacks us. He wants to attack our worship of God. He will, you know, say hateful things, lying things, try to distract us, mock us. But the idea, ultimate goal is to stop us worshiping. He doesn't want us to offer up ourselves as a living sacrifice to God, but rather he wants us to not do that, but to, again, focus on him rather than Jesus. I think that's why it's so important often when we see the darkness around us to not be focused on it. It could be beneficial to learn about, let's say, false teachings or things that are going on, but it's what's more beneficial is just to focus on Jesus, worshiping him, and not get distracted with finding, you know, all the darkness around us, but rather focus on what we're called to do and to worship him. And so, and we see, you know, another thing here, he's doing this mocking in front of his brothers, and this word brothers could be reference to an officials, but most likely is the reference to his brothers as well, like physical brothers that he has set up in official positions. An army here, we see, is just an army. He has an army set up. So it's meant to be a physical presence before the people. And so upon hearing this, we have this prayer of Nehemiah that we already covered before. Verse 4, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you. For they were provoked you to anger before the builders. And so this, I discussed this before about this prayer, so I'm not going to repeat myself, but I do want to mention two things that it's interesting that for us, from the New Testament perspective, this is not kind of a prayer we want to pray. God is, we are to pray that God will cover people's sins, that he will forgive them. What he is praying here is, Lord, don't forgive them their sin. That's Nehemiah's prayer. But it's also not inaccurate prayer for him to pray, because we know from the Old Testament in particular, in the covenant that they had, that if those who resisted God's people were cursed already. If you go back to Genesis 12, when God said, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And he dealt specifically with the nation promises and so forth. And the blessing that comes through Abraham and people of God. In other cases, those who have, God has, through prophets, we've seen, pronounced judgments upon those who resist God and his people. So in many ways, Nehemiah is just praying these things very scripturally. And so we go on to see verse 7. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, and the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, heard that the wall of Jerusalem was being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry. Verse 6. I skipped that one. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half of its height, for the people had the mind to work. And so here what's interesting, after the prayer, we see that they reached the half point, meaning halfway of their intended height of the wall. And in chapter 6, when we get to verse 15, it says, so the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. So ultimately it took them 52 days, which is a fast time to complete the wall. So this might be, if it's the half the size, could have been around the 26th day or somewhere about when they did it. And then we go back to this verse 7, as already read before, that upon them finishing, that the enemies got very, very angry. Verse 8 as well. And all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. So it's interesting, this anger is expressed, this hatred that they have for the Jewish people because they're again surrounded by their enemies. Now we see some new lists here, some of the nations added, Ammonites, the Ashdodites, that's opposing Arabs we encountered because in chapter 2, we encountered this man Goshen, who was most likely the leader of Arab people south and east of Judah. And so we're just given the list of all those who opposed the work. And it's interesting that they got furious because of the gaps were being closed. That's one of the things that's mentioned. As I mentioned, when the wall was ruined, there was these openings. It was easy for them to come and attack and steal and all so forth. But now the gaps are being covered. They're being filled in. And it produced a great upset among them. And I think it's, again, a beautiful picture for our spiritual walk is that we all at times have weaknesses, or we have weaknesses. Doesn't matter what it is. And those are our gaps in our wall. And it's important to have those gaps covered, not to have them exposed. It's always important to allow wisdom to kind of guide us in the areas of not allowing gaps to exist. And we really don't want to be in that place. And we'll see this later on as they kind of settle people in defense, is that we want to focus on defending, especially those gaps in our life. Verse 9. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. So because of their attempt to bring confusion and scare them and ultimately threaten them, Nehemiah is acting wisely. He's not acting fearfully. He is not allowing fear to guide him, but he is being wise. He's taking their threats seriously. And so he is not pretending that they're going to disappear, but he's going to deal with their threats. And now as Nehemiah is kind of setting this watch, trying to organize protection, we read in verse 10, then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build a wall. This rubbish that Sanballat made reference to earlier. Now, what we see here is that the discouragement is creeping in among the people. People are, the tribe of Judah is really being affected, being Jerusalem, being its city and so forth, largest tribe and so forth. But they're looking at this amount of work that's ahead of them. And rubbish in particular, where are you going to put it out? You're surrounded by enemies. And they're getting discouraged. And it's interesting when you think about it, discouragement at time is the greatest enemy. You know, the enemy can be your opposition, but if you get discouraged, that's what actually will keep you down. The discouragement can be a big distractor and actually one of the best defeaters in your life. But I do find it ironic that who is saying this? Judah. But what does Judah mean? Praise. That would be the solution for them, is to take their eyes off of the problem, in a sense, and focus on God. Focus on praising God. That would be the solution to their problem. So we read in verse 11, and our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come in their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So they're seeing the work, then they're hearing the enemy saying things, whether it be through spies or them hearing them or speaking to them, whatever it is. These things were a cause of discouragement. Again, they were listening to the enemy. They were not focused on what God had. And when you listen to the enemy, well, things are discouraging. You know, when you see the problems, when you see the opposition, when you see the challenge, when you see the difficulty, if that's the focus, yeah, you absolutely get discouraged. But again, if you keep an eye on God, well, things are different. The difference between, you know, two spies over the 10 other spies that were sent into the promised land, Joshua and Caleb. Everyone else saw the problems, the challenges, the enemy, the difficulties. And, you know, it's not like Joshua and Caleb did not see those. but they had eyes for greater things, and that is God. They could see God in that. They could see God working through that and with them to defeat it. And sometimes when we face challenges and we walk defeated and are defeated because we don't see that God can do it, that God can solve those problems. And so we read in verse 12, "So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, or whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." This is not Jews who did not live in Jerusalem, but came from surrounding cities, as we've seen in previous chapter, who would come to work. And they would hear these reports, these stories of challenge themselves, whether it be from their friends, family, people surrounding them. They would spread these discouraging words. So everything around them was discouragement, discouragement, discouragement. And then they use this phrase, you know, told us 10 times, he says, whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Now this 10 times may not be literal 10 times, but idiom for just large number. You find it in many places in the Old Testament. Phrase 10 is just referred as a large number of references of things happening. Genesis 31:7, Numbers 14:22, Job 19:3 are all references where this phrase 10 times is used. So everywhere they looked was a discouragement. But, you know, thank God that Nehemiah was convinced of his calling. And so we read in Nehemiah in verse 13, "Therefore I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall and the openings. And I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and rose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, 'Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses.'" Again, thank God for Nehemiah. He was determined more than, I think, stubborn, and maybe both at the same time. But he knew what God called him to do. He knew that God was on his side. He knew that he had the favor of God upon him. And he understood that in spite of all these challenges and opposition that he was facing, that God was still with them. Because he knew God was with him. And, you know, it's so good to at times to be like Nehemiah. You know, there's times in our lives where, well, things are just going the wrong way. Everything's going the wrong way. It doesn't seem that there's much light or hope kind of at the end of the tunnel. And we need to be like Nehemiah, determined, well, if I'm God's will, I am, then I just need to keep going. And just like David in Psalm 22, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you're still with me." If I'm walking in God's ways, if I'm in God's will, guess what? No matter how big the darkness it is, it's still not greater than God's light. It's still not greater than God. And so he is acting wisely, and so he's positioning people in an interesting way, in a way that will be probably challenging for him to set up, because he's setting up the workers to, and people who are defending the city in front of their homes. So in one way, it's challenging. If there's an attack going to happen, their family is right behind them. But in another sense, it's good because it will give them a motive to fight. It's their family. It's their home. It's their brothers or sisters that will cause them to be more vigilant in the battle. And then he reminds them, hey, and I love he puts their eyes on God first. Remember the Lord. He says, don't be afraid. Why? Because you need to remember the Lord. The Lord is with you. Just like, again, this idea of not fearing. We saw that on Sunday. Remember the Lord. He is with you. He's great and awesome. You fight because God is on your side. He is with you. Now, it's kind of, I find it in all this ordeal fascinating in many ways when you consider Sanballat and Goshen mentioned the Arab, and these guys seem to be the leaders from some of the historical records we have. They knew that Nehemiah had a blessing of the king. So if they were to attack them, they'll be going against the will of the king of Persia. So how bent on attack was he, I can't tell. But it, you know, shows me the irrationality of hatred. That you would dare to do something that's actually in so many ways bad against you. If he brought attack and the word got to the Persian king, well, it wouldn't be good for him. Remember when Nehemiah came, he came with the king's blessing and king's army with him. Sanballat saw that. That's why he was upset. But it's interesting again to me that how hatred can drive you to a place of rationality and you can justify pretty much any action at that point. But Nehemiah is being a good leader because he's reminding people to put their eyes on the Lord. And so we read verse 15, and it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. Notice Nehemiah's part of this work, all of us, he makes reference to return to the wall, everyone to the work. But enemy herds, they realize their tactic won't work. It could have been just simple show of strength. At first they showed their show of strength by army. Now Nehemiah responded by a show of strength and determination. We're going to fight till to death if we need to. And so the enemy got discouraged. So we read on in verse 16. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, bows, wore armor, and leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other held weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. So it's interesting, we see that Nehemiah had some servants who were with him, half working on the wall, half being soldiers. And then we see those who were working, who were building, that, you know, they armed themselves as well. And builders who actually needed to have both hands available to work were doing that with, well, they had swords attached to them. So they had their tools for work and then they had their tools for warfare presence. And then and others would have maybe spears and do some other works that they could do with one hand and so forth. But I love this picture. They were fully prepared to engage the enemy if need be. They were prepared for the attack. And what a fitting thing again for us, the parallel in our life. And how do we face, in a sense, the enemy? Well, according to Ephesians, by putting the full armor of God, which obviously includes prayer, worship, God's words, preaching the word, all these things that are part of Christian life, being on guard. And I, again, love how Nehemiah, this whole ordeal as we read this, he's setting up people, he's making sure that where there's weak spots in the wall, where the weak spots, he was making sure that there's a defense there. And again, the parallel for us is that you know, where we have our weak spots, we don't leave them open, but we close them up. If you struggle with something, you don't push yourself in that position where you're going to struggle more, but cut yourself away from it. you know, it's in Corinthians, I think Paul says that we are to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And sometimes the greatest battle we face and greatest temptations we face is in our minds. And I love that verse because it gives us the way out. When the thoughts come, we take it captive and we surrender them to the Lord. You know, we at times can get shocked with things that come out of our hearts or our minds. Where did this come from? But guess what? The Lord is never surprised by it. Two, He wants us to fully surrender. When we have a struggle, we are not to hide it, but we are to surrender it to Him, allow through prayer and God's words to be exposed. So it will be fixed. That gap will be protected. That weak spot will be addressed by Him and His Spirit. And I love the fact that Nehemiah was not a coward, because he had a guy who sounded the trumpets with him. That's, we read in verse 19, "Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we see and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of a trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." Nehemiah was not a coward. He was a leader. He could easily just be like with some of the leaders we've seen just previously, who would just put kind of a be behind and just be there. No, if there was to be an attack, he would be the first one going there, because the guy with the trumpet will go and then he will sound the trumpet and everybody will come and rally there to fight. Nehemiah would be the first one to respond. And I can only imagine how encouraging this was to everyone else. Because when you think about it, why was Nehemiah in Jerusalem in the first place? This was his forefather's city, but he did not live in Jerusalem. He lived in the palace of Susa. A comfortable job serving the king, the safest place to be. Probably the most coziest job you could have. He didn't have to come to Jerusalem. He didn't have to expose himself to this danger. But he did, willingly. Obviously, as we discussed, he had the burden and the love for the people in the city. And so to have somebody who literally, you know, doesn't live in this city, said, "I'll be the first one. I'll be in the forefront of things." That was a big boost in morale for the people. Because as we discussed at the beginning of the study, they were already discouraged by many things. And Nehemiah was truly the leader that they were lacking. Somebody who was willing to take all the risks and say, "We need to do this." And we will see this battle, this struggle right now that he has with the enemies is just one of the things he will have to do. And one of the things he probably didn't expect that he will have to do is many other things that he would not expect that he will have to do, that he will end up doing. And again, it's a great reminder for us. When we walk the Lord with the Lord and we step in faith as we decide to do things, at times, Lord will put us in places and positions we never expected to find ourselves. But He is always there with us. God will fight for us, as He says that. God will fight for us. He is the one who speaks of the Lord to them. He is being reminding them, "Hey, you're God's people. You're serving God. God is in control." You know, don't forget always that God is for us. And in Jesus, as believers, we are more than conquerors. We will never lose the war. There's many battles, some be up and down, but we never lose the war. In a truest sense of the words, as a Christian, you will never face defeat. You will face different stages of the war, but you will never face defeat, because Jesus made us more than conquerors, according to Romans 8:37. Because we have a captain of our souls, right? Jesus. So we read then in 21, so we labored in the work, and half of the men held spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be on guard by night and working and at a working party by day. Excuse me. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men on the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. So here we can have a summary of some of the things that has happened. And one of the things is that, A, he told people who were not living in Jerusalem not to go back to their hometowns and surrounding areas, but to stay in Jerusalem. And also he says that they all had arms ready. They were all ready for battle. But I also love the fact that even at night, after all that work, some of them did not sleep, but stood guard. They were committed. I mean, how easy would it be for them to say, oh, man, I'm just so tired. I did all this hard work. All I want to do is sleep. You want me to be on guard? But they did. And they even changed their clothes. They were battle ready all the time. Ultimately, work ready all the time. And what a beautiful picture for our Christian walk. We're called to the work of the Lord, the battle that's ahead of us. And we are in a battle. We are in a war. Again, not against people. But we are. And it's how easy it is at times to say, I'm just too tired to pray. I'm too tired to worship. I'm too tired to fellowship, to be part of the Bible study, to study the Bible, to read. So easy to say. And I think at times, the weakness of our body brings us to the place of defeat. And I think Peter, James, and John learned that lesson really hard when they went to the Garden of Gethsemane with Jesus. And he asked them, hey, stay up and watch with me. And they couldn't. We are told they were tired. So they had a legitimate excuse. It's not like they were just lazy. They were tired. Jesus not once kind of rebuked them for their tiredness. But they gave in to the weakness of the flesh. That's what Jesus said. Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Pray therefore that you enter not into temptation. You know, sometimes being a Christian is a very exhausting thing. It requires everything of us to just remain floating, just to be above the surface. But we're not to give up. You know, there's times when we really have to give everything. Not always will they have to do this. Eventually they will stop and they will face other challenges. But at this time, they understood the severity and seriousness of this situation. And we also need to be like that. There's times where we have to recognize the severity and the seriousness of the situation we find ourselves in. And we are not to lose hearts. As Nehemiah reminds us, to keep our eyes upon God. So, that's chapter 4. Let's pray.